going to lay down my heavy load.
Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we'll be talking about faith and music. We'll learn about Sister Rosetta Tharpe, one of the first great recording stars of gospel music.
These Pentecostal churches had a big influence on early rock and roll and this just excitement and fervor and filling with the Spirit.
And we'll hear about the story behind a song that became an American icon.
Amazing Grace would have spoke to their desire for an experience of freedom, of one day seeing God face to face, of being with Him for all of eternity, and no longer subjected to the type of cruel treatment they experienced during slavery.
And we'll catch up with photographer Roger May, whose project Glory depicts images of Pentecostal-style revivals in Kentucky and West Virginia.
I think there's something to be said about perseverance and being faithful to what you feel like you're called to do.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. That's Sister Rosetta Tharpe. She was a singer, songwriter, and guitarist who became popular in the 30s and 40s. In fact, she became the first superstar of gospel music. Along with her powerful, passionate voice, her rhythmic style and charisma captivated an entire generation of rock and rollers. There's Rosetta Tharpe singing Amazing Grace, an old American hymn with a complex history. Later in the show, we'll find out how the song moved from the church into mainstream America, and we'll learn more about a project depicting current Pentecostal-style tent revivals. But first, she's often called the godmother of rock and roll. Sarah McConnell spoke with a music historian about Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Not many of us have heard of her, but Sister Rosetta Tharpe was a major influence on Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, and Johnny Cash. In fact, before he died, Johnny Cash called Tharpe his favorite singer. Chris Kajornis is a professor of music at Longwood University and teaches a course on the history of rock and roll. Chris, tell me about Sister Rosetta Tharpe and where she came from.
Well, she was born in 1915 in Cotton Plant, Arkansas. Both of her parents were amateur instrumentalists, and their life really centered around the church.
Her mother was a strong woman with no fear. She was what they call a stomp-down Christian.
Yeah, she played guitar and tambourine and would even go and just sit out on the steps and play and try to bring people to Jesus.
So, Rosetta Bell, what was she like during this period of her early, early upbringing in Arkansas? Was she singing at age 2, 3, 4?
Yeah, and there's great stories of her being lifted up on the piano and singing before the congregation. It's pretty clear that she was playing the guitar from about the age 4.
So her mother eventually leaves Arkansas and moves to Chicago with Rosie.
She would have been 6, and she was obviously exposed to this very emotive Pentecostal music. Pentecostal music was exciting. It was fervent. There were no limits. They were one of the first churches to have live instruments. And so she was soaking all of this up. I think you hear it on this 1960 recording of Sit Down, where she was playing the solid body electric guitar, and you just feel this energy. You can hear her stomping her foot, and you can just imagine everyone jumping up and stomping with her. This is the church where people would end up speaking in tongues and rolling in the aisle, and I think we feel this urge to do that as well when we hear this.
Sit down. Sit down. I can't sit down. Go away. Don't bother me. I can't sit down. I feel so happy and I can't sit down. Sit down. No, I can't sit down. Sit down. No, no, I can't sit down. No, 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 I can't sit down. I feel so happy and I can't sit down. Who's that yonder dressed in white? I
That is electrifying.
She's a one-woman powerhouse. To see video of her brings it home, too. It's just so amazing to see this woman. And there weren't videos made until the 60s, but she's in, you know, full dress all the way down to the collar to cuffs and just up there ripping it up.
That is her playing the electric guitar?
That is.
Was she religious herself, like her mother was?
That's always a tough question, because there's certainly things that she did that would not fit with what you would think of as a religious person.
But she was gaining in the 20s almost wild popularity with the African-American gospel church-going audience.
Yes, and then as the 20s give way to the 30s, she ends up in Miami, and you have one of the strangest scenes we can imagine, where she's performing at a temple in Miami, and they begin broadcasting this on the radio. And so now all of a sudden, people outside of the Black Pentecostal community are hearing Sister Rosetta Tharpe and start coming to the temple. You get this very bizarre scene where you have white listeners, you have Jewish listeners that are packing the balcony while the congregants are down on the floor and everyone is enjoying this music. And we can hear that excitement that was generated. When we listen to Didn't It Rain, this is one of the really wonderful duets that she would record a little bit later on with Marie Knight. And you can imagine hearing this on the radio and going, I want to be where that is.
I can imagine hearing that on the radio for the first time. It's electrifying.
Absolutely. And I think that when we look at the explosion of rock and roll and all the excitement that came with this hot music, these Pentecostal churches had a big influence on early rock and roll, and this just excitement and fervor and filling with the Spirit. Women swooning and passing out when they see an Elvis Presley or a Beatles and they're hearing this music relates much more closely to what you would see at a Pentecostal service than what you would see at, say, a blues club. So at a certain point, Rosetta Tharpe decided to go to New York and will actually start performing at the Cotton Club. And she was still performing a lot of her gospel material, but she was also starting to experiment with integrating secular music. This was a shock to the fans that had come up knowing her as the singing evangelist. She was taking gospel songs and putting a twist on them, which may or may not be sacred anymore. If we listen to this recording of Rock Me, which she did with the Lucky Millinder Orchestra, we hear that. First, let's listen to a more church-oriented version of this by the Salah Jubilee Singers. And so this is wonderful song by Thomas Dorsey about being sheltered and protected by the Lord in your times of trouble. Now, Sister Rosetta would take this, and the way, the inflection that she put on the term rock me and the way she rolled the R's was quite shocking at the time and suggested something much more worldly than this sort of protective spirit.
You brighter. You make my burden lighter. do good wherever I can. Oh, let thou praise and thrill me. Thou loving kindness fill me. Then you hold me. Hold me in the hollow of thy hand. You hide me in thy bosom. Tell the storm of life is over. Oh, rock me.
Oh, God.
Right. And, you know, here she is. She's doing the sacred material, but there's something else going on here. And on top of that, she was recording purely secular songs, songs she recorded with the Lucky Millinder Orchestra, Tall Skinny Papa. There's no double interpretation of this that has anything to do with sacred and secular.
Her popularity did soar during this period, though.
It did. This was the period where she would have a publishing contract with Irving Mills. This is when she would start recording for Decca Records, which was unheard of to have anyone singing anything like gospel on Decca. They had experimented briefly with Mahalia Jackson, but had no success. So she was at the height of her popularity during this period. In 1944, she would record what would be her most lasting sort of masterpiece. And this is Strange Things Are Happening Every Day. This was with the Sam Price Trio. And one of the interesting things about this recording is Sam Price is playing boogie-woogie piano on this. Price himself was a little bit hesitant to do this on a spiritual record. But again, Sister Tharp said, hey, if it's in praise, it's all good.
All we hear church people say, they are in this holy way. There are strange things happening every day. On that last great judgment day, when they drive them all away, there are strange things happening every day. Every day.
Every day.
Every day.
Every day.
And this record in particular would really predict a lot of the things that became the rock and roll revolution in the 1950s.
How so?
Well, I think rhythmically you hear it. It has a different feel than the swing that we heard of Rock Me. It has something that's more visceral and more pushing forward, a lot of that coming out of the piano. This record in particular became extremely popular in Memphis in the 50s, thanks to Dewey Phillips, who was a white DJ who is sort of credited as the person who broke Elvis regionally. Johnny Cash, in his Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction speech, said that was his favorite singer as a child, was Rosetta Tharpe.
Really?
Yeah.
And he would have heard this on the radio.
Right. He would have heard this on the radio and also on the records. Records were making the rounds, and her popularity extended beyond just black audiences. One of the most interesting stories about this particular song and Rosetta at this time was when she was playing in Macon, Georgia, and there was a young man who was working in the theater there. He was waiting in the wings to catch her attention and actually started singing this song. She said, well, that's wonderful, and invited this 12-year-old boy to come on stage and sing with her. And that was actually Little Richard.
No.
Yeah.
That's
so
great.
She gave Little Richard his first gig, and he has said that was his favorite singer at the time as well. Some of her best material came in 1946 when she started recording with the singer Marie Knight. Their music is so dynamic and playful and exciting, and is probably, by my estimation, some of the greatest music recorded during this period of time. This particular song, Up Above My Head, really illustrates the way they're able to feed each off of each other and create something extremely powerful.
Up above my head.
Up above my head.
I hear music in the air.
I hear music in the air.
Now up above my head.
Up above my head.
I see trouble in the air.
I see trouble in the air.
Up above my head.
Up above
head.
My head.
great. Where does she really belong in the history of rock and roll? Did she inspire rock and roll, or was she just a really terrific singer who helped influence guys?
Well, that's an interesting question. And there were people that were hearing this music and being inspired by it and bringing it into what they were doing. One of the things that's thought of as being very important about rock and roll is that it was biracial music, and it was music that challenged the racial status quo of the time. Well, Sister Rosetta Tharpe had toured the South with the Jordanaires. So here is this black woman leading a band with white background singers in the middle of the segregated South, and this is in the 1940s. The Jordanaires were actually very popular with Elvis Presley, and when he went to RCA, that was the group he handpicked to back him. So when we hear something like Hound Dog, those background vocals are the same group that were touring with Rosetta Tharpe.
Oh my gosh, those are the Jordanaires?
Absolutely, yeah. And Gail Wald, who wrote this wonderful book on Rosetta Tharpe, would have interviews with them later, and they talked about Elvis really admiring Rosetta Tharpe, not just as a guitar player, but specifically as a singer, and really being inspired by her music. As we look at this more and more, it's time to reevaluate where we put her in this sort of history of rock and roll. The Million Dollar Quartet, the very famous photo taken in Sun Studios with Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis Presley and Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash, all of them were influenced by Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
People fighting one another, I think they're doing swell.
That was music historian Chris Cajorns speaking with Sarah McConnell, host of the show With Good Reason. That interview was originally recorded in 2013. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear the story behind Amazing Grace. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound. It sure is to me. That's Sister Rosetta Tharpe singing the old gospel hymn. You'll hear her again in our next segment. You see, Amazing Grace is an old American hymn that everybody recognizes. It's a song that even moves people who have no feeling for the spiritual and religious. But its origins are unexpected and complicated. Trey Kay has the story.
In 1748, a slave ship was heading back to England from Charleston, South Carolina, after having discharged its cargo of African natives. They were getting closer to home, just off the coast of Donegal, Ireland, when bam! The ship gets battered by a violent storm. The boards of the hull are popping off, and water is gushing into the hold. It seems certain that the boat is going to go down. The captain and the crew work frantically to patch the leak. The captain orders a man named John Newton onto the deck to steer the vessel.
And he has to strap himself to the helm to avoid, you know, sliding down the deck.
That's Steve Turner, author of Amazing Grace, the story of America's most beloved song.
And it's at that point that he becomes a Christian. He vows that if his life is saved, that he's going to pursue this relationship with God.
Miraculously, the ship survives the storm. Newton keeps his word and devotes the rest of his life to the Christian faith. Now, this is a famous story, and it's usually spun into some triumphant, I've seen the light moment. The story goes that Newton, who had worked in the slave trade for years, at that moment renounced slavery. But did Newton really have a conversion?
He didn't leave the slave trade immediately. In fact, he went back to Liverpool and became the captain of a ship for the first time, and he did three voyages as a captain of a slave ship.
Newton would captain slave ships for another 14 years. During this time, he was devout to his Christian practice, but he never saw his work in the slave trade as being at odds with his religion. After health problems drove him ashore for good, he eventually made his way into the Anglican clergy. Newton became the priest of a small chapel in the English town of Olney. Over time, he began to write hymns to accompany his sermons. On New Year's Day, 1773, he introduced his congregation to a hymn that was inspired in part by his near-death experience at sea. It's called Faith's Review and Expectation, but it's come to be known by its opening phrase.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
That's Deborah Carlton Loftus, executive director of the Hymn Society of the United States and Canada.
Well, it wouldn't have been to the tune that we all recognize as associated with Amazing Grace.
Newton didn't write the tune that we know. Actually, he didn't write any tunes for his hymns. He wrote his verses in a common meter that could be sung to many different melodies.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
It's often said that Amazing Grace was written by an abolitionist. But John Newton wasn't an abolitionist when he wrote it. He never spoke of slavery from the pulpit. And it wasn't until 1788, 15 years after he wrote the hymn, that Newton finally spoke out against slavery, publishing an anti-slavery pamphlet, and becoming, finally, an outspoken abolitionist. But at the time, having written Amazing Grace wasn't his claim to fame.
Was Amazing Grace a popular hymn in England at the time that John Newton wrote it?
Actually not. It was not very well known, not considered in England to be one of his finest hymns, but it came over to the United States and picked up some usage and popularity in the revival meetings of the Second Great Awakening.
The Second Great Awakening was a Protestant revival movement that began around 1790 and continued into the late 1850s. It started in western New York and moved down through the Ohio Valley into Kentucky and Tennessee. Folks would travel in covered wagons from far away to camp for a couple of weeks, worshiping with preachers from various denominations.
Thousands of people would come together for these outdoor revival meetings.
Singing was a big part of these meetings.
There were choruses and refrains that people could learn quickly.
At the time, America had several schools that had the purpose of training teachers to help church congregations engage in the beautiful harmonic singing of sacred words. Enthusiastic, even ecstatic singing was the hallmark of these large camp revival gatherings. Music scholars believe Amazing Grace was sung at these revivals to many different tunes. William Walker was a singing teacher in South Carolina who published a songbook called Southern Harmony in 1847. That's the first documented instance when Newton's words were set to a tune called New Britain. Deborah Loftus says that back in the heyday of the revival meetings, it wasn't only whites attending.
We have documented that both free black persons and white people were together for these outdoor revivals, and there was a lot of interchange of musical styles.
These singing styles were passed on through the generations in African-American families. We're hearing the singing of a family who are descendants of slaves that were featured in the 1990 Bill Moyers documentary about Amazing Grace.
hitherto and said, I have already taken.
Well, I think the song would have had a great attraction for the African slaves that were in chattel slavery, in bondage, in cruel, horrific oppression.
That's Reverend Matthew J. Watts, pastor of the Grace Bible Church in Charleston, West Virginia.
Amazing Grace would have spoke to their desire for an experience of freedom, of one day seeing God face to face, of being with him for all of eternity, and no longer subjected to the type of cruel treatment they experienced during slavery.
When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining.
Pastor Watts is singing a verse that today is often included in performances of Amazing Grace, but it's not something that was written by John Newton. That's because Camp Revival music leaders tended to do a bit of mashing up of hymns, singing them to different tunes, lifting verses from one hymn and singing them in another. That's what happened with Amazing Grace. In 1852, some of the verses written by Newton, along with the When We've Been There 10,000 Years verse, appeared in the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin. Tom sings these Amazing Grace verses in his darkest hour. Author Harriet Beecher Stowe was the daughter and sister of revival preachers, and she may have heard Amazing Grace sung this way at a revival meeting. Some think her novel may have played a role in shaping how we sing Amazing Grace today.
So it's a moment of fusion between traditional, you might say, high society, white culture, and popular culture, black culture, revival, evangelical culture.
Jim Basker teaches English and history at Barnard College, and he's the editor of Amazing Grace, an anthology of poems about slavery. He says Stowe had met with runaway slaves, and she read slave narratives, and that she knew the song would resonate with African Americans.
So when she reached into that scene, and this is a moment of fusion between whites and blacks, it's a white woman author creating one of the most memorable black characters in all of 19th century literature, she reached for what would be the paradigmatic song from his soul that he might sing on his deathbed, and it's Amazing Grace.
The first recording of Amazing Grace was in 1922 by a group known as the Original Sacred Harp Choir. Around this time, the hymn was adopted as a folk song, and musicologist John Lomax and his son Alan were famous for capturing authentic folk performances, like this 1935 recording of Kentucky folk singer Aunt Molly Jackson. In the 1920s and 30s, there were the beginnings of a recording industry catering to the demand for songs appealing to a religious black audience. That's Reverend J.M. Gates' recording of Amazing Grace, which sold thousands of copies. And throughout the century, all of the great gospel singers would record the song, like Sister Rosetta Tharpe. During the Civil Rights era, activist Fannie Lou Hamer would lead protesters to sing songs like Amazing Grace, helping to define racial equality as a moral and religious pursuit. By the 1960s, white folk singers were finding their way to Amazing Grace, like Arlo Guthrie, who sang the song at Woodstock.
I once was lost, but now I'm found.
But Guthrie's version was not nearly as popular as one by another white artist who would soon follow.
My name is Judy Collins.
In 1969, Judy Collins was attending what she calls an encounter group when things got really contentious. Collins' record producer happened to be there.
And he said, you know, people are really at each other's throats. Isn't there anything you could do to settle them down? Why don't you sing something? And my grandmother was a church-going Methodist, and she had taught me Amazing Grace when I was a little girl. So I sang Amazing Grace. It was one of the few songs that I knew that I figured everybody would know something of, and they all sang, and it did settle everybody down.
The next day, that same producer called and said, we have to record that song.
So I said, well, let's go into a church somewhere. And so we went up to the campus of Columbia University, and we went into the chapel. It's called St. Paul's. It's a gorgeous chapel, and we all got together and we recorded Amazing Grace.
"'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear."
Elektra Records released Collins' recording of Amazing Grace on her 1970 Wales and Nightingales album.
My record company was flabbergasted. They didn't know what hit them.
The album went gold, and her recording of John Newton's hymn became a top 40 hit. And then it seemed like everybody, black or white, rock or blues or country, wanted to put their own signature on the song.
Amazing grace, how sweet
the sound that saved a wretch like me.
Now I'm found.
Judy Collins' recording of Amazing Grace was also a hit on British radio, which means that two centuries after Newton had penned it in England, where it never really caught on, it was finally finding an audience. This caught the ear of a bagpiper from the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards, who was inspired to give Collins' arrangement a Highlander feel. The Dragoon Guards' recording of Amazing Grace also became a major hit in England, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and South Africa. Collins liked hearing her arrangement on the bagpipes.
And I am thrilled that it has now permeated the police and firefighters.
For centuries, bagpipes have been an important part of Celtic funeral traditions. But the Dragoon Guards' recording sparked the tradition of piping Amazing Grace at memorials for police, firefighters, and military. It's certainly a tradition New Yorkers know well, after the attacks on September 11th, 2001.
I can hear it. You know, I live on the Upper West Side, and about a block from me is the Firefighters Memorial on Riverside Drive. And so every once in a while, we hear the bagpipes coming up from the river, and we hear them playing Amazing Grace. And we see like 5,000 firefighters out there in the street with their uniforms. It's an amazing thing. It's very moving. And it's, of course, the appropriate place for this song to go. I mean, it belongs in these situations, because it is regenerating the idea of hope and forgiveness.
Amazing grace, how sweet.
And after a mass shooting at a black church in Charleston, South Carolina, President Barack Obama offered the song's message of hope and forgiveness to the mourners.
A wretch like me.
Author Steve Turner
You know, Obama sings it at the church in Charleston after the murders, and you know, it's sung when policemen have funerals in New York. It just seems kind of like an all-purpose, hopeful song.
Barnard College professor James Basker says the song, both the musical notes and its lyrics, appeal to people at moments of intense suffering.
And they appeal without any narrowness. There's no specific condition, there's no specific religious faith, there's no specific cultural context. It's just about that thing that human beings share, which is pain. And the imaginative yearning, and this is the thing about human beings, we're able to imagine and to yearn for joy and peace, for relief from the miseries of this world. So it's the use of the human imagination, both the creative one that made the song and the receptive, interactive one that can identify with it, that lifts us up.
Amazing Grace.
Throughout its history, Amazing Grace has spoken to Americans' belief in new beginnings and reinvention.
That's a very important part of the American mentality, you know, that you can start again, that you can come from nothing and succeed, and you can overcome a bad or dubious or hampering past. So all those things are in the song.
I want her.
You can feel as though you are lost. And somehow know that you'll be found.
But now
I'm found.
What you say, girl?
But now
I'm found.
We still can't feel you.
But now.
That was Trey Kay, host of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's podcast, Us and Them. That story originally aired on Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from PRI and WNYC. High-energy Christian services held outside are typically called tent revivals today. At the celebrations of faith, you still hear upbeat gospel hymns, the kind that inspired many American rock and roll artists. And you'll still see people dancing and clapping on the downbeat of the rhythms. To document some of the remaining services, Roger May started a project called Glory a few years ago. On May's personal website, rogermayphotography.com, one photograph shows a woman standing under a tent surrounded by women with arms outstretched while a man in a black suit has his hand on the woman's forehead. Another photograph shows a handmade sign that reads, Tent Revival, 7 p.m., sitting in front of a large bush. The photos are from tent revivals in eastern Kentucky and southern West Virginia. May recently sat down with me to talk about the photos.
I'm familiar with, you know, Pentecostal holiness movement, and grew up in a Free Will Baptist church, and have seen all manner of faith practices practiced here in the mountains. But I don't know that I'd ever been to a tent revival. I'd driven by and seen them before, but don't know that I'd ever been to one. And so when I pulled up in the parking lot, they had already started singing and playing music. And I sat there for a few minutes, and I watched a guy get up from under the tent and walk out and walk toward me. He introduced himself and asked me to come in and be a part of the service. And I said, well, I'm a photographer, and, you know, I've always wanted to photograph a tent revival. Would it be okay if maybe I made some pictures? And he kind of patted me on the arm and said, honey, you can take pictures of anything you want to. And if anybody has a problem with it, you just tell them to come see me. And I didn't know it at the time, but he was the preacher. And so I kind of felt like, you know, if he was giving me the green light to be there, then that was okay.
So you said you're familiar with sort of a Pentecostal-type religion in growing up, but you had never been to a tent revival. What have you learned about tent revivals?
I guess the takeaway for me has been just the persistence and the sheer faith of these folks, because there's nothing glorious about what they do. I mean, they're faithful servants. I mean, Brother Roger stays in a camper with his family, and there's no air conditioning. It's the summertime, and he's out for hours each evening preaching his sermon to an audience of, you know, maybe three people one night, maybe 30 people the next night. So I think there's something to be said about perseverance and being faithful to what you feel like you're called to do.
How important is it, do you think, to photograph tent revivals as far as depicting a part of Appalachia?
Well, for me, it's super important to me because I think it's something that's slowly dying off. It's a tradition that we don't see much of. You know, I was talking not long ago with someone about foot washing, you know, and I grew up in a church that, you know, they would wash feet, you know, on a fairly regular basis. And I think about those traditions that I know are still practiced, but they're maybe not known much outside of the region. And so I think tent revivals fall into that category of something that could be celebrated and should be preserved and shown in a way that that sort of embodies the dignity and respect that it deserves.
Why do you think that they have lasted as long as they have here?
I think it's the people. People like to gather, the element of faith. People gather around faith. There's an aspect of community that I've seen in West Virginia and Kentucky that I've never seen anywhere else. You know, there's that whole saying that, you know, you never meet a stranger, you know, and that's what I think about when I pulled into that parking lot and Brother Roger got up from under the tent and came out. I mean, as soon as I pulled up, he came out to meet me. And I don't know that I've been to too many other places that I can say somebody would do that.
But I think they might do that at like a beer fest too. Like they might come and greet you at that too. Do you think there's anything unique about the tent revivals or the people here that makes tent revivals last longer?
Faith. I mean, there's pretty strong faith, element of faith, and kind of walking out what it is that you feel called to do, I think is what was, you know, happening in that situation when he got up and came to my car and invited me in. I think that level of persistence and that commitment to faith is what drew him out to do that. And that's, I've got to believe that that's an underlying theme of why he's still, you know, doing tent revivals, you know, and people like to be a part of something bigger than themselves, you know, and whatever that is, whether it's faith or whether it's sports or, you know, this Looking at Appalachia project, I think, you know, we've had some success with that because people see that it's a community.
That was photographer Roger May talking about the photos he's taken of tent revivals in Central Appalachia. Roger May is the director of the Appalachian South Folklife Center in Pipestem, West Virginia. He's also the director of the project called Looking at Appalachia. You can find more about his projects on our website at wvpublic.org. Today we've been talking about religion and its influence on Appalachian culture and especially our music. Next, we're going to hear the final installment of Colt Brogan's Struggle to Stay story. Colt's a native West Virginian who considered becoming a preacher when he was a little kid. His Christian faith was and still is an important part of Colt's life, and recently, he's even started going to church again. Colt told us it's how he holds on to hope. During the past few weeks on Inside Appalachia, we've heard Colt talk about his mom, how he stopped using drugs, and how his life changed when he was selected to work for a farmer training program called Refresh Appalachia. He has a dream to have a farm of his own, and he wants to stay in West Virginia. But like so many others in this state, making his dreams a reality is tough.
If you want to stay here in West Virginia, then I believe you're doing something right. Because it's hard to want to stay here, in my opinion. It is so rough.
Last time we heard from Colt, he was struggling to juggle work and school, and on top of all this, his mom's house burned. Nearly everything she owned was destroyed. But as he told Roxy Todd, lately, things have started to look up.
The fire was rough on Colt. He didn't hear from his mother for weeks at a time, and he lost a lot of sleep worrying about where she was staying and what would happen to her now that she was homeless. He and his mom drifted apart again, and they haven't spoken much over the past few months. But in many ways, the winter was a turning point for Colt.
To me, 2017 is a year of second chances for a lot of people.
One of his cousins is trying to get off drugs, and Colt says he's hoping others in his family and across West Virginia can get sober too.
I just feel like in this year, I think for a lot of people, it's time to make your peace.
He's feeling optimistic, partly because he's doing well at his job. He He was awarded the youngest crew member of his company, Coalfield Development, to become a crew leader. He was also elected president of Coalfield's crew member council. So basically, he gets to represent his coworkers and advocate for ways to improve their experience, kind of like the student body president for his program. He and 11 other coworkers got together at a cabin in Logan County, West Virginia, back in January for a work retreat.
Basically just a time for us to get together, you know, the entire team, and be able to kind of focus what we want to do as far as team building.
Above where we're sitting, there's a stuffed boar's head mounted to the wall. And across the room, there's a stuffed bobcat, a stuffed squirrel. Colt points out that the decor creates a manufactured rustic feel.
There's a pretend outhouse and a pretend tree with stuffed animals on it, and the lighting, light fixtures are buckets and deer antlers and leather couches, and everything's made of wood, it seems. And I like it, though. It's really beautiful.
Everyone is staying under one roof, cooking food together, meeting about their jobs, but also just connecting as a team. Especially important has been hanging out with the Mingo County crew, all of whom are laid off coal miners.
And I love the people. They're super just positive people, which is strange to me because of all the like hardship that county's faced, you know, even worse than my county, you know, even. Their voices are probably the least heard in general, so it's nice for me to come down here and be able to talk to, connect.
Before dinner, Colt plays pool with one of the crew bosses, James Russell, a former coal miner who helps manage the Mingo County farm. James likes this song. Then Colt goes downstairs to help with dinner. About six people are squeezed into the kitchen together, making salad, chicken soup, all with local ingredients Colt and his coworkers have grown or raised over the winter. One of his coworkers, Crystal Snyder, slides a baking pan out of the oven.
We got the quiches in the oven, so I washed my hands. Now I'm reflecting.
Crystal and Caroline are two of Colt's closest friends at work. Like him, they're both based out of Lincoln County. With their help, the Lincoln County crew has been raising more veggies and selling to markets. And they've even started to grow shiitake mushrooms. Work isn't the only thing going well for Colt. He proposed to his girlfriend, Adriana, over Christmas.
You know, it was weird and awkward, but we were having an argument. Having a big argument. And I was just questioning, like, our relationship in a, not in a big sense, but just in a, like, why are we arguing sense. Like, it just didn't make sense. I just wondered if she was so bent out of shape that she wouldn't marry me. And I asked her theoretically. And then she said yes, and I pulled out the ring and said, "Will you marry me?" Well, I used her full name and got down on one knee and everything, but...
So you had the ring on?
Yeah, I had the ring.
So you'd been thinking about it?
Yeah, yeah. Didn't want to for a long time. I just had to get the ring first. I didn't have to, but I just wanted to. I thought she's worth it.
Remember, Colt met Adriana back in high school a few years ago in agriculture class. They've been dating for about 2 years. One night last year, she explained into a small recorder why she's proud to be putting herself through college by working at a Burger King.
So I understand what hard work is, and I never asked my mom. I didn't. Like, when I wanted something, I tried to find a way for me to get it, at least after I turned 16 or so, because she could barely give us the things that we needed, let alone the little extra things that I wanted.
Adriana is getting her bachelor's degree in agriculture at West Virginia University. Outside the Burger King in Hamlin, where she works on the weekends and on school breaks, she explains why she wants to come back to work in Lincoln County as a high school agriculture teacher.
I feel bad for it, honestly. This county, this town, this state, because it deserves so much better than what the people are giving it. And that's part of the reason why I want to stay, because the only way to make things change is to influence the people around you. And I feel like if I am the agriculture teacher, at least the co-ag teacher at Lincoln County High School, if I can stay here and show people that there is a productive resourceful way out that's not just coal mining or fracking or having like a buttload of kids just to get a check. Like, there's a way out, and it doesn't have to be the easiest road, but it is the most fulfilling road.
Back at the Logan County cabin, Colt tells me he feels confident he and Adriana will find a way to stay in West Virginia.
I mean, everything in me feels born and raised here and feels a part of this land and feels that just like anywhere else in America right now, it's going to take the people with inside of it to make it stronger. I feel like I'm where I need to be. And I feel like in that sense I'm blessed because so many people's had to move, or some people are trapped and can't move or whatever. I feel like I was really put in a perfect situation because I never had any assets, so I can't lose any. So that's a plus to look at it that way. You know, my backpack is light. You know, if I had to, I could leave. But if, you know, if times get hard, like, I'm not hurting so bad because I don't have anything to lose. I don't own a home, or I wasn't like a coal miner that was living a high lifestyle before. Like, I've always been poor, so I'm good at it now. And I'm going to try to work towards sustainability. So that's how I feel about being in West Virginia. I feel like it's where I was meant to be. Everywhere in the state, there's a story like mine. I feel like there's countless stories like mine. I think people need to know the problems out there so that they can find those solutions. They need to know what we really face as a community and what kids are learning. So, you know, what the future generation has to hold because of what they have experienced and how emotionally and mentally disturbed a lot of us really are because of what we did have to go through.
Colt still doesn't know what he'll do next year, or even if he'll graduate from Refresh Appalachia. But he's staying hopeful. The uncertainty, he can live with that. Because, he says, the journey is worth the struggle. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd.
It's the struggles that often test our faith. Our faith in our government, faith in our spouses, faith in ourselves, and our faith in God or perhaps a higher power. You know, music is a powerful thing in Appalachian culture. Used to express many different things, passion, heartache, joy. Amazing Grace has helped me to say goodbye to so many people in my life. So this week, it seems appropriate that we shared the story of the iconic song. I've sung Amazing Grace at several funerals, and I feel like I lost a part of my soul recently when I heard that my close childhood friend, Ashley McNeely, passed away. His last message to me read, "It's all love." And I pass that message on to you and have faith that his legacy will be carried on in love always. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Studio 360, With Good Reason, and the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and the Looking at Appalachia Project. Music in today's show was provided by Judy Collins, Marisa Anderson, Dinosaur Burps, and Sister Rosetta Tharp. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.